Football is life, amigos. This is Chip Sutterth, and welcome to the Incomparable Network's week-by-week recap of Ted Lasso. It's episode 8 of the second season, a light confection of an episode, an escapist respite from the real world. It's Man City, and joining me for this are Incomparable regulars David J. Lohr.
Can I at least be the dragon this time?
And Jean McDonald.
Yes, I assume this is not a date, just a podcast.
And joining us is Tom McGrath, Chicago actor, a friend of the Incomparable Radio Theater. Tom, welcome to A Football is Life.
I'm only here until my podcast exists.
So, yeah, Man City. Funnily enough, everybody's talking about this one because, oh my God, is this the Wham episode of the season? Is this the arc just sort of revealed as opposed or just hammered home after we've been leading up to it? So just quick overall impressions about this thing before we dig into the specifics.
Yeah, I mean, I would say having predicted. I don't normally predict things. And the last time I was on,
I knew you were going to say that.
Well, see. The last time I was on, I made predictions because I was defending it and saying, you know, these guys plan this out meticulously. They have crafted this show. It does not get the credit because it's not a puzzle box like Lost. But they have built these little things in that pay off weeks, even years at this point later. And so, yeah, there were a number of things that came to pass in this episode that I was like, yep, I saw that. I knew they were laying that groundwork. And it's been so nice to see, you know, all of the discourse in the first couple of weeks. Oh, Ted Lasso has lost the thread. No, you're just impatient. You're not seeing the full picture of the season yet. Just watch it.
I am so grateful that I have just missed the discourse on social media.
It's so yeah. Dumb.
I just and missed it.
And the thing that, you know, I love Bill Lawrence. He's a longtime online friend, and each week he's been like, yeah, you know, this is my favorite episode till next week. And he said that again this week. So I can't wait to see what comes next.
Yeah. Gene, is Ted Lasso, can we now start calling Ted Lasso a dramedy rather than a comedy? I mean, what kind of show have we got here?
Yeah. I mean, I think this is the episode. We certainly got bits in, you know, season one and this season. But I'm not going to call it a dramedy because it still is laugh out loud funny. And some of it is just pure, like, adorable. When I first watched it, I was, like, laughing until I was crying. Then I thought, I don't know, I have to rewatch it because we want to talk about it, and I actually need to take notes. But I was really avoiding it, and then as I was watching it, I thought, wait, it is funny. There's a lot of funny things and adorable and the sort of life-affirming things that we loved about Ted Lasso to begin with. But yes, it takes a pretty dark turn. The darkest, I would argue, since the beginning. But it's still... They end with... I think it's a rom-com.
Yeah. Good point there. Tom, what's your relationship with Ted Lasso prior to this episode and coming into Man City?
I got onto it as the rest of us did midway through a global pandemic. Maybe you've heard of it. So we downed the first season as quickly as possible, and then I told my wife that she should get into it, and she and I watched it as quickly as possible, and now we've been keeping up with the second season like the rest of you have. It clearly comes from an improv background, a long-form improv background. Like, that's the thing about all this stuff that's buried in all these callbacks and all this, like, wait for it, wait for it, wait for it. It sets stuff up for a long game, which I think is the thing that people forget about it.
Yeah. And I mean, Sudeikis and Hunt come from
Precisely.
Chicago improv. I mean,
yeah,
they know what they're doing. And you put them together with Bill Lawrence, who crafts arcs and has these wacky sitcoms that can also hit you in the solar plexus really hard. You know, that's in Scrubs. It's even in Cougar Town.
But those guys,
it's a terrible name. But but those it's guys a show that can be poignant.
Didn't just come from Chicago, if I'm not mistaken. They also did Boom Chicago in Amsterdam.
That's right.
Which is
they started that.
Which is a bananas concept. That they were doing just for themselves for a long time, because it was a bunch of Europeans who were like, oh, we've heard of this improv, you call it? What is it like? And they're doing improv for people, you know, English as a second language. And so it's just all craftsmanship. It's all Swiss watch stuff that they're making on the fly.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it is. This is meticulous television, and I love it so much. So, in case you forgot, since you watched it last, you know, there's some really dark stuff in this episode.
What?
The reveal of Ted's father's fate, the conflict between Jamie and Jamie's father, and where that comes from. And it's heartwarming, but it's also a little problematic, this love story that we get starting in this one. So heavy, heavy stuff. I want to start off this podcast, though, with just a lightning round recap of the fact that, as you said, Gene, this is a comedy. There is some fall down funny stuff that happens. I'm just going to rapid fire. Remember this. You may have forgotten this because of all of the hurt and tears. The Coach Beard and Coach Kent stare off. Colin getting stuck under the barbell twice. Yes. Thanks, Jamie. Thanks, Isaac. Everybody gathering around, you know, this not just hilarity, but heart. Everybody gathering around Sam as he gets his three dots in banter again. Roy with Phoebe's teacher and that last line of effing glitter.
That's so good.
Mm-hmm. Sharon's concussed voicemails. The haircut scene. Leslie in the broom closet, which is the stupidest and most hilarious sight gag of the season, I think. I'd like it closed. You get less questions.
Yeah.
Can I be the dragon this time? No.
No.
The awestruck arrival when they get into Wembley, not to mention the fact that, you know, the location shooting at Wembley, and Ted's lack of knowledge about pitch sizes in old Wembley. Coach Beard talking about the accidental mushrooms. Coach Beard falling over the partition during the debacle of the loss. The second stupidest and funniest sight gag of the whole season. This is a hilarious episode when you get past the tears. And I wanted to just sort of lean into the comedy for a moment and get your reactions to some of the funniest bits, the comedic highlights.
Oh, so many. that we find out that Dr. Sharon, when she's on her bicycle, she is actually she is willing to like yell at people and tell them that their dog hates their sweater.
Yes.
was not expecting that, which of course makes it more poignant that when she does fall off the bike and later admits like that is my happy place. Well, it's her place where she can say what's really on her mind to people.
When the professional role is down and she can just be real, just be herself.
Yeah, I love that.
They took their time with this comedy too. Like,
yeah,
Ted takes what, 22 seconds to drink a glass of water, and we just watch him.
Yes.
Oh my god.
That's the third funniest visual gag for no reason.
The beauty of that being, you know, here she is. She wants him to leave. She doesn't want him to stay. And yet she's polite enough to offer him a drink and then gives him a full glass.
And
yeah. What are you doing?
And he's so polite that he's not going to not finish it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Fun new branding opportunity. That was hysterical. Just Keeley saying, like, I just need somebody to be a spokesman. It pays good. Just a fun new branding opportunity. Just one whatever. And both of, you know, Roy and Coach Beard are like, you know, looking at her like not in a million years, not a snowball's chance in hell. And that she's like, Roy says she gets us. She gets us, the two of them. And then
I'm increasingly convinced that Beard is not human and that he is actually pod peopling people around him. And Roy's the first to go.
I just love, you know, when she goes, oh, fine. Okay. And she walks out and Beard just says, I appreciate that we didn't have to say anything.
Yeah.
She gets us.
She gets us.
And then, of course, Nate Brightley walks in and says, hey, I'm going to be a spokesperson.
I'm going to be a spokesperson.
Oh, Tom, favorite funny. Tom, favorite funny moments for yourself?
They buttoned everything. So, like, the thing I was thinking of, we already talked about the, can we play Princess and Dragon? Can I be the dragon this time? No. And then there's the like, fourth button of, okay, then you better have fixed the wand. Okay, we're going to give you as much celluloid as you can fill. Like, just keep going. which is brave, because bringing a joke for like an extra beat is a scary thing, and they do it, how many times this episode?
Yep.
Effortlessly.
Yeah.
They keep topping, and it's so good. Oh my God.
David, what's your top comedy moment?
I don't know. I mean, certainly the Princess and the Dragon, and the whole school scene, capped with effing glitter, because
yes,
you know, my 16-year-old howled at that,
because
he knows
people, among the people who recap Ted Lasso. I really love what Linda Holmes is doing for her recaps for National Public Radio, and every episode she recognizes a bit player who's a most valuable player, and the actor who played the teacher in this scene was just spot on.
Brian Grubb of UpRocks does something similar on Mondays, and I'm looking forward to seeing where she lands in that pantheon as well.
And again, I love that they set her up earlier in the season.
Oh, right? I forgot about that.
Mm-hmm.
That's the same one as like, Coach Kent, you cannot curse at the children.
You can't call them pricks.
Yeah.
It's like,
but they are.
But they are.
And the callback to that was, well, is he? She goes, that's not the point.
Absolutely.
I think that's another example of one of the things that this show is so good at. Very, very rarely is somebody you encounter just their job or just the stereotype of their job. Everybody's a fully realized person, right down to the effing glitter reaction of the teacher.
Yeah. And one of the nice things, and I've been wondering, again, it was like, I trust them. I don't worry about it. But there were people in the beginning of the season who were like, oh, you know, they've added this character, and she's the noble black therapist replacing the perfect black friend who's just there for the white guy to realize his problems. And I was just like, they're going to do more with that. They're going to go outside that trope, and they're going to let her be a human being. And this is the week where we finally get her as a full human being. We've had glimpses, right? Even in last week's, we had glimpses of it. And we trust that, but this is the week where she lets her guard down a little bit. We find out that she is in therapy herself, and her therapist says, "Yeah, you gotta meet him halfway."
Yeah, I'm going back
to trust you.
I'm going to Vulture now. Vulture had an article. Ted Lasso reveals its long game, which talks an awful lot about Dr. Fieldstone and the trope of the black female therapist, and how the show is really standing that up on its head. Highly recommended.
Yeah.
It's also a show written by somebody who's clearly been to therapy.
Yes.
Because it is for real.
I mean, I was saying this in season one. This series is very psychologically astute, and this season is just, you know, doing that exponentially. You know, all of his reactions last year, his panic attacks, the way they set them up, all just, you know, this is crafted by people who've experienced these things mm-hmm. and understand them. And this season, you know, people who have been resistant to therapy. If you've ever resisted therapy, or if you've been someone trying to help a person who's resisting, you recognize this. Mm-hmm. And the beauty of this episode, it's not about recognizing that, hey, you have a problem and I need to help you. It's about the people themselves recognizing that they have a problem and saying, okay, yes, I can reach out. Mm-hmm. Yes, I can tell you, I can trust you.
It's what Beard in particular does.
It's not just Ted
does.
And Sharon. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It really is.
And the show is also exploring, and it hasn't come up with a solid answer yet, because there is no easy one to, when do you give space and when do you sort of come in to help? That tension there. At various times in the last few episodes, when somebody is struggling with something, or somebody sees a relationship that's not working, there are disagreements over what the right thing to do is. Right. And for a show that's built on notions of interpersonal accountability, to be having those conversations, I mean, it's great. So we've done the lightning round about the comedy. Let's talk about some of the drama here. Well, we were just now talking about Dr. Fieldstone. Let's
I have a good scene to segue from the one to the next, because it's a serious scene that's also funny, and it's the theme of it, right? It's that moment where they're about to go out on the pitch. You know, it's the coaches coming together, and we're going to, Richmond, right? And Ted says, hang on, I need to tell you why I left the last mm-hmm. match. And he says, I've been suffering panic attacks. And they're all like, oh, well, okay. And then one by one, they each have a progressively funnier confession
yes.
that they want to share with everyone. But it is still thematically about sharing these details and being open and honest about these little annoying things, maybe.
And Ted is grateful, appropriately grateful, at the end of that, because they just didn't leave him hanging there.
Yeah. And then they just go, all right, butts on three. Butts. And it's a dumb button at the end of that moment. But it's like, yes, we can be serious and we can still be funny. What do you mean? It's not that Coach Beard was drinking or was high on mushrooms for a match. It's that he was drinking tea. What's come over you, man?
Yeah.
What's wrong with you?
Yeah.
That's the button on the button.
Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, if you go back earlier in the episode, the first, like, at least for me, like, where it was like, okay, it's not funny anymore. I mean, it's funny, but it's not funny, is, well, Ted bringing Dr. Fieldstone back to her apartment. And the first, like, beat is that he sees she has four bottles of liquor and wine on her countertop. And I was like, oh, you know,
and
like
she sees him notice.
She sees, of course, like they hold that. Like that was uncomfortable.
He can't even not verbalize that. He has that oh moment when he sees it.
Right. And
then he like putters around into the front room and he's like trying to find something to say.
Yeah. And he can't. He's like, well, you know, oh, corporate housing, you know, I guess it's not supposed to, you know, be it's not supposed to stand out or be cozy. That's the whole point. But the other part that got me was the home entertainment center. When he says, oh, home entertainment center, I see. I mean, you know, as somebody who lives alone, sometimes you get a setup where you can have an entire place to live, but you basically have your one couch or small chair and your TV and so this is not what I expected from her apartment, right? Like, maybe the alcohol, you know, but definitely that she's watching TV, and she's not just watching public television documentaries about, you know, culture. She's watching Les Conker's All Stars, and yeah. I'm like, ooh, I also have watched shows like that. That's what you watch when you need to, like, switch off, as you need, you know. And so that got me. And actually, I would be interested if somebody can enlighten me. When she says, I'm sorry, I don't have any beer. It's water or wine. And Ted says, oh, the chicken or the egg. And I was like, what does that mean?
I think that's turning, a Jesus joke.
Turning yep. water into wine.
Ah,
so you have okay. you have both.
You have the chicken and yeah. the egg. Yeah.
You don't okay. you don't need the magic.
Yeah. And I will point out something I would not have picked up in the first watching without pausing, which I did not, is the book he picks up.
Yeah.
It's on, which is Middle Passage by James Hollis. I went and, you know, looked all this up, but the subtitle is From Misery to Meaning in Midlife. And that's both of them.
Yep.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, very much. And it's kind of told as well as shown in this episode right at the beginning. You know, first, I love that the show reveals that Dr. Fieldstone has her own therapist. This is a common thing. You know, we are seeing yes. how He's real recommended. Therapists.
I think it's almost, you know, it's almost, I mean, assumed. Like, I think most therapists also talk to another therapist.
Yeah, but you never, you almost never see that on, you know, that's in
comedy.
Media. In media.
That's true. that's a good point.
So their conversation sort of makes explicit things that you could have read into the show all along about, you know, about their individual avoidance mechanisms. You know, she talks mm-hmm. about him avoiding difficult truths by spouting off some obscure reference to something very specific to a 40-year-old white man from middle America. And I love mm-hmm. how specific she is about yeah. that white man from middle America avoidance strategy. So there's all that set up there. But they go back to showing in the apartment with all the stuff that you mentioned, Gene. And it all sort of comes together when they have the conversation while Ted's playing pinball when he's checking up on her with the concussion protocol, you know. Mm-hmm. I was scared today, really scared. I don't want to discuss it. I don't need the pep talk, Ted. I just wanted to tell you how I was feeling, and I'm glad I did it. Yep. I have mm-hmm. seen some commentary here and there, you know, how are the boundaries between Ted and Sharon? Is this a real good example of the therapist-client relationship or colleagues, you know? The lines are a little blurry here. I think she was brought mm-hmm. in to work with the players, and but Ted's sitting metaphorically on the couch with her, too. You know, it's a little complicated, but most relationships are. We see so much more of Sharon in this episode, stuff that has already been seeded. You know, she's always been a fairly well-realized character, but we got some real quality time with her this time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, she was always very professional and as one would expect from a therapist, you know, I mean, in a professional setting, the team members and the staff are not, she's not there to be their friend. And that fact that she, you know, in a previous episode says, like, okay, you get me for one drink, you know, after they had won their last match and they were so excited and they really wanted to share it with somebody who they really like, that, you know, that she says, okay, I'll go out with you for one drink. Even though the players are like, oh, can we even be asking you to come out with us? Like, they've already, like, cottoned on to, like, some of the protocols of the therapist-client relationship, which is also interesting.
And it's a balance, right? I forget who said this. Sorry for interrupting. It's a balance. I mean, it's somebody said this, and I wish I could remember who now, but there's some research that says that technique matters less than building a trusting relationship with your client. Like, you can try any sort of philosophy as you want as a therapist, but if you don't meet the person where they are, you're not going to get anywhere. And I think that's really interesting in this case, because you do have to keep a professional distance, but it is nice to have a friend in the room as well.
Yeah. To a certain extent, that's true of the coach as well as the therapist. I mean,
just so.
Ted is still woefully unqualified to be a British soccer coach, and yet he reaches his players for the most part. And, you know, are they as successful as they need to be? No. But are they reaching above themselves? With the exception of the game in today's episode, yeah, they are.
Mm-hmm. Well, and one moment I loved in this was precisely when they're talking on the phone and she says, "I was scared today." And he starts into his, you know, "Hey, you know, fear is like underwear." And she goes, "No, I don't want the Ted Lasso treatment, right? I just want you to know this, and I'm glad you were there, and I'm glad I told you." And it basically says, yeah, I see through your coaching tricks. I see through your pep talks. I don't need that. I need you to be this right now, right here. And that's, I'm going to accept you on that basis. And to his credit, he picks up on that. And he says, all right, yeah, I'm not going to piss you off with a pep talk. I'm just going to listen. And it's a big step for her, but it's a huge step for him. And, you know, because in a lot of the interactions, and especially if you go back and watch the series multiple times, not that I have. No,
yes,
I have.
You have.
But
yeah.
I have.
I don't think any of us can claim not to have.
I'm on the fourth run of season one.
All right, you win.
But, well, I've been watching it with each family member one by one. I'm hooking them all. Anyway, in a lot of his interactions, you know, you see, he again, it's the trope of the motivational coach, right? Hey, I'm going to help you. And that you can kind of see that he's overcompensating sometimes, especially when he's in a panic mode, especially when he's, you know, last season dealing with his wife, right? And all these things, the problem that she had with him was that he was so positive and so overcompensating to help every time. And this week, we find out why. And, you know, and they set that up so nicely a couple of weeks ago when he says, you know, when Jamie first approaches him and says, you know, "Was your dad like that?" He says, "No, my dad was harder on himself than anyone else."
I don't think he said no, though. I think he just said my dad was harder on himself.
Yeah.
Like, it was a good answer to not be answer the question.
Right.
The answer is yes.
And that was when I called it, but that's when I was like, oh, they're going to make it. They're going to make it about his dad's suicide. Like, it's going to be that his dad committed suicide, isn't it? Which they also set up in season one. Like, you go back with that knowledge, there's a bunch of, not just the darts game, but there's a bunch of stuff that's like, oh, I see. The fact that he wouldn't go to therapy on his own, he went to this couple's therapy with his wife's counselor, and he felt like he was trapped. That's the sign of somebody who had trauma, hates the fact that they had trauma, and will only go if they know they're not going to, like, win therapy. You know what I mean? Like, he set himself up for failure in that regard, too, because nobody in the right mind wouldn't get a third party involved. Fourth party.
Yeah.
A fourth party, which, yeah. But I know people who have done that.
Oh,
and
for sure.
It was the Ted Lasso result as well. I feel like they... That person
that therapist really has to be a neutral party, and the relationship has to be balanced. Let's move on to the heavy stuff, and we've started going there. But this episode,
magic wand.
Yeah.
Did they ever fix the magic wand?
No, I think that
that uncertainty just looms over the end of this episode, I'm telling you. So the episode starts with a really scary, violent moment with Sharon's accident. There's blood on the pavement. You know, it's really worrisome.
It's dark.
And we, as soon as we see that she's recovered, the episode resumes with the lightheartedness and the funny stuff that I breathlessly recapped. But it's really helpful to have that really shock to the system at the front end, because that psychologically prepares you for the stuff that's coming at the end of the episode, which is absolutely gut-wrenching. We have Jamie's dad coming into the locker room, being as abusive and irredeemable as Rupert ever was in season one, to the point where Jamie is just broken and then pissed and then a solid punch to the face and then just a complete breakdown in Roy's arms. And that leads to the revelation about Ted's father. So, okay.
Well, and how you have dads as a theme all the way through this episode. I mean, it's through the series, but particularly
they're really
right, you got Sam's good dad, you got Jamie's bad dad, but absent dad and surrogate dad.
Even before that, you literally start with Jamie getting a call from dad in quotation marks. He doesn't even he has air quotes around his father's name. Yeah. Right? And he ignores it. He's like, I'm not gonna answer that.
And
it's not like
Sam's dad is perfect either.
No.
Which I like.
No.
Like, his dad is real. But they love
each
other.
Right on top of that, you know, Sam gets a call and Jamie is listening. Mm-hmm. And that's why Colin gets the, you know, the heavyweight on his throat.
The first choking.
The first time. But you have that contrast right then and there. You know, I'm proud of you. You inspired me. I love you. I love you too. Talk to you later. Right? And so he's got that eating at him. You also have in the background, not this week, but through the series, we have Nathan's father.
Yep.
Right? Mm-hmm. And that's a problem. You also have Coach Beard's parents. How's your mom? Oh, she's going full QAnon. It's a joke, but it's not a joke, right? And so, and even Higgins talks
Higgins
about,
is the dad, though. He is like...
He is the good dad.
The really good dad. And when he talks about his dad,
yes,
it's complicated, but that's... You know,
I try to forgive him for who he is and not blame him for who he isn't, which is a wonderful distinction. And so then you have Roy, you know, what about Phoebe's dad? Oh, he's, you know, and so we make explicit that, Phoebe's dad is terrible and that Roy is a good surrogate dad. And, you know, and he says point blank, I love every moment I spend with you.
Yes.
Which that's never been obvious. Actions, but he's like, you know, you want to come to the podiatrist with me?
He's never made it explicit.
Yeah. And this was such a beautiful moment between the two of them.
Right. Phoebe says, like, can we get ice cream? And he's like, expletive, no. And then look to the teacher and says, F no. And I'm like, nope, that's... And then the next scene, they're eating ice cream, of course.
Of course.
Thank you for the ice cream, Uncle Roy.
Which he also has the second best, like, line of that scene, which is... What does she say about being...
Best of you, or something like that.
I'm as good as the best of you.
That's it.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, I worry that you're getting the worst of me. And she says, no, you taught me to stand up to bullies. And I can do that without cursing.
And the way Brett Goldstein reacts to that stuff, you know, just magnificent acting. I do want to bring it back. It's important to have all of this dad stuff set up. But I do want to bring it back to that locker room, though.
You can't
have that moment without having Roy and Phoebe in the car. You need to see him becoming that father figure. You yeah. need to see him realize that he has an effect on people, that a father has an effect on people. And then when he sees Jamie's father's effect on people, he realizes, I can't say anything. I can't insult this stupid little prick that I've hated my entire time with Richmond.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that I can do, the right thing to do, is to just walk over to him and take him in the biggest, tightest hug I can and not let him go, because that's yeah. what he needs.
And Jamie accepts it, because
yeah.
which is informed by Higgins saying, I love my father for who he is and I forgive him for who he isn't. That's talking as much about Roy as it is about his real dad.
Yeah.
That's fair. Yeah. That's fair. Phil Dunster, amazing performance. Yeah. So broken.
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, he didn't even look like himself. Like, when he was standing there, just the whole body language, the facial expression was genius. And
line delivery.
Yeah. Don't talk to me like that. Don't speak to me like that.
Yeah.
Oh.
There's been some discussion in the discourse about that, like, they haven't given Jamie anything to do. And it's like they haven't given him a real chance to act. And they're like, ha-ha, take this.
Well,
it's like, you know, again, pay attention to the episodes.
Yep.
Yeah.
You know, Jamie is not instantly redeemed, right? All through the season, it's been a slow build. It's just subtle.
Yeah,
Oh, my God.
I think that there was
some... Can we have subtlety?
I think that there was some fear that he was going to become more generic by becoming... an accepted part of the team, but instead you get his arc with the through line, so that it's not just he's one of the boys. It's not just routine when he's there on the sidelines during the haircut scene, hooting it up with the rest of the team watching as Sam gets his haircut. But the fact that he actually is one of the boys. It's not just Ben automatic. He is part of the team, to the point that he is the one, when they're walking back towards the locker room off of the pitch, he's the one who shouts into the echo, Richmond. He's not saying me. He's saying Richmond. I think the only and it's not really an off point here for me, just you have to notice, is that everybody in the locker room is just sitting there taking in Jamie's father being so abusive to Jamie. Not sure what to do, not sure how or whether to intervene. This sort of default ethos of let them steer. You know, let Jamie steer. It doesn't really happen until after Jamie punches his father and Beard escorts him through the door. Not out the door, through
moment.
It. Yeah.
Oops.
So
watch the door.
So my wife Shannon and I were watching this, and it was my second time, her first time. And she was saying, when this happened, you know, Sam, do something. He was there. Jamie was there for you. It's your turn, Sam. And then, no, it turns out to be Roy. And she's like, okay, I accept this as well.
Not to get too inside football about it, I wonder if there was a point where they were breaking this that they wanted to have him lose a close game. And they wanted to have it be something that they almost pulled it out and they didn't. Because I think that getting just waxed is such an exhausting being done by the end of the first half, and coming back and in the second half not doing any better and giving up an own goal in the second half and everything else. It's just so exhausting that the last thing, everybody is so upset with themselves and upset with everything else.
They've got nothing in the tank, huh?
Exactly. And you can't, like, and so this other guy comes in and is like, one more thing, and they can't. Well, they can't get out of their own heads fast enough, and then you're just watching a car wreck. And interestingly, whenever somebody starts to, like, when they cut around, as soon as they start cutting around, Jamie says something, And I think it's, I think that's built so that, okay, we're going to give him this space because he's trying to do something here.
Right.
Because they've all also been in therapy. All of them have been in therapy at this point.
Yeah, right.
Yes, yes.
And they're watching this kid do it.
And part of the whole conflict is that, you know, Jamie's dad wants tickets to the game. When are you going to get me my tickets? And he just wants free tickets. Come on. And he shows up in Man City colors.
I was, and the first time I watched it, I was like, wait a second. What? You know, like that, that is possibly like the worst, like, betrayal and, like a treacherous moment of a parent I have ever seen on TV.
But that was his team. He was so excited last year when Jamie was playing for them.
And he does have his kids. And he does have his kid's jersey on.
Yeah. And so he comes in here.
Or his own jersey.
It's not kind of.
That's true. It could be a vanity jersey.
It's not just that they're totally exhausted. They've been shellacked. It wasn't even close. Mm-hmm. And now they're watching this guy and they realize this is the guy who turned Jamie into the person we didn't like before. But we've all talked about this and we've come to terms with this. And we see that no. This is why. This guy's a son of a bitch. And now he's insulting all of us. You know, where he keeps insulting them. And no offense, no offense. Immediately on top of what he says. And I think part of it is also they don't trust themselves not to just punch him out and
throw him
through the doors themselves. Right?
Yeah.
But it just plays out so beautifully.
And there's something to be said for James Tart calling his son Jamie until he's an adult. It's just so
infantilizing.
Yeah.
Well, so as a chip, I can't say anything.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
not your name.
I've been Tommy to adults. Like that's fine, but when you use it as a weapon.
Gene, last thought about Jamie's dad before we move on to Ted's dad?
Yes, and it's a little bit of a digression that's been on my mind since episode 2 when Dr. Fieldstone said her favorite book was The Prince of Tides. And, Ted Lasso has been very, deliberate with its book references, and last season I ended up reading Wrinkle in Time because they mentioned it, and I was like, oh gosh, why haven't I read this in such a long time?
Well, you and Sam, as it turns out. Sam was reading it on the bike.
Do you expect me to be the little girl?
Yeah.
Yes.
And then the F word. But the but they dropped it, and then it was dropped in and never mentioned again. Nobody was reading The Prince of Tides in this season. And I was going to read it, but then for reasons, I decided to just rewatch the film. And it's uncanny. I mean, I think if you really want to understand certain things about Ted Lasso, you got to watch The Prince of Tides. Actually, watch it.
Yeah.
And watch Nick Nolte, who is a character named Tom Wingo, which I always thought was a weird name, like Ted Lasso. And
he's a football coach.
He's a football coach. He gets into this, I don't want to call it a relationship exactly. Eventually, it becomes one with a psychiatrist, Dr. Lowenstein. And it's basically, it's uncanny how much of Ted's performance mimics some of Nick Nolte's stuff. I'm mixing my actors and whatever. But yeah, the Tom Wingo is the one who says, am I supposed to lie down on the couch? And Dr. Lowenstein's like, do you always make jokes instead of conversation? Like, there's tons of that in there. And even at the worst moments, I mean, we don't really know yet the depths of Ted's trauma. We've learned a very important thing, but we don't know. But Tom Wingo, his brother was killed, his family was traumatized in the worst possible way. He will if he mentions it, then he immediately goes to a joke. It's like more Whiplash than Ted Lasso. But what surprised me about this episode, because I figured, like, come on, like, what, now that Ted's starting to sit with Dr. Fieldstone, we're going to get to this, like, it's time for me to rewatch Prince of Tides. Well, that it's Jamie and who has the moment that is very, very much, you know, from the Prince of Tides, which is he has to cry, you know, and it's Roy Kent is the Barbra Streisand in this moment. Anyway, it kind of blew me away, and I'm still interested to see if they ever even refer to it again, because the fact that they mentioned it once, and it's not a weird book, it's just a weird book to throw into what we thought was a comedy. Actually, when they mentioned it, I thought, okay, maybe not so much a comedy anymore.
Yeah, a weird book for a buttoned down, very observant of boundaries psychotherapist.
Yeah,
to favor
British.
Yes,
I mean, it is a very Southern United States story.
Super well, Southern and Northern, because of course Lowenstein is like, you know,
there you go.
But also, at least, you know, Dr. Fieldstone seems to be way more professional than Dr. Lowenstein. but it's a mess. You know, it's all a mess. But it did blow me away again. I mean, I hate to recommend it because it is such a it has a lot of trauma. Although it was nominated for X number of Oscars. Like, it's definitely a film that was popular for good reasons. You know, it had all of the elements of what makes a respected, you know, big box office film of 1991, FYI. So anyway, that was what surprised me, because I assumed it would be Ted. I assumed there was going to be like Ted's father is so mean and so much of a abuser of his entire family, which we still don't know that he wasn't, but we sure as hell know that Jamie's father is the worst dad on TV now.
Mm. And one thing that was, when they had that conversation, you know, what's your favorite book? And she said The Prince of Tides. And I immediately was like, oh, that's a detail. We need to pay attention to that, because they're tipping their cards, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Ted's favorite book is apparently The Fountainhead.
Yes.
And there's that split second where you're like, that doesn't make sense. And the more I think about it, the more it really does. And it's his favorite book, perhaps not for the right reasons.
Yeah, I think it feels like
most people would.
It feels like a misread. Like,
it feels, yeah, yeah.
Like, it's, oh, you it's, took the
it's
wrong.
That,
it's the people
who... Well, it's
the
self-confidence.
Yeah.
Right? That's what Howard Roark is. The first line is Howard Roark laughed, and he's standing over this quarry with his hands on his hips like Robin Hood and Errol Flynn, and just
damn.
and it's that his perfection, his idea is the most important thing. And through the whole book, that's it. It's his self, his creation, the thing he makes is perfect. Yeah. And the rest of you can go to hell. And that kind of tracks with some of this.
It kind of does.
There is one more book reference I just want to throw out there at the end of this episode that maybe is Ted's real true favorite book, which is Bird by Bird.
Yes.
By Anne Lamott.
Yes.
Because that came up in the first season too.
Mm-hmm.
Did it? Oh, I forgot.
Mm-hmm. Bird by bird, coach. Maybe not that bird.
Yes.
Yeah.
Great line.
All right. So I think we've...
Is there any more plot?
Yeah, there's just a slight... There's a slight other thing that happened in this episode.
What? Oh, yeah.
And it might be the rom-com part of the story. So the penny finally dropped between Sam and Rebecca. And the amazing thing for me about this is even Rebecca at first says, this is not happening. I'm your boss. Mm-hmm. She realizes how young he is and says, I was grooming you, when they're talking about the banter. But between the actors and the director and the writer just slathering Sam and Rebecca with staggering interpersonal chemistry and just opportunity after opportunity for each of them to have consent and agency, even though this is a boss and an employee kind of thing, and there's some uncomfortable stuff about that, even though they are both full on going into this thing. And I wanted to see how it played for you all and where you think it's going to go.
I was excited when they set up banter in the beginning, where the whole concept was that you don't see each other, you don't know each other. It's literally just your words.
That's the watch mechanism again.
Right? And so immediately I thought, two people are going to get connected here, and it's not going to be people we expect, and it's going to be funny, because the whole thing is built on a rom-com pattern. I mean, Roy mm-hmm. and Keeley, it's all proper rom-com and done beautifully. And so when they sort of revealed that it was Sam and Rebecca that were having this conversation, and I immediately flashed back to which episode was it last year? It's the one where they're going to do the burning ceremony to exorcise the ghosts mm-hmm. yeah. in the stadium. And Sam shows up in her office, and he's very shy and says, I would like to ask you to come out tonight. And she takes him, you know, what? No. No. And he goes, no, not for a date. No. They set this up last year, too.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, amazing. When she said that, I thought, wait, she really jumped to a big conclusion there.
Yeah.
But apparently not.
And he is insistent in that moment too. I'm going to insist that you come to this thing, to the mm-hmm. stuff burning.
You're part of the team, and it would mean a lot if you were there.
Yeah. He may be self-effacing,
but he's persuasive.
But he is persuasive. He's a footballer. He's a yeah. footballer in a Premier League team at the time. He is not going to have a shortage of self-confidence.
Yeah.
And I don't care if he's 21 years old. When they realize that they are each other's date, Sam is like, okay, we're doing this then. And it takes Rebecca a much longer time to become comfortable with that idea.
Yeah.
And she crashes into the stool, and then that other family comes in and interrupts her.
Right.
It's brilliantly staged, and they do so much with so little actual dialogue that that's the thing that never ceases to surprise me, because this was the same thing in Make Rebecca Great Again. The last mm-hmm. 7 minutes of that episode was silent. Or, I mean, it's just the music.
Yeah.
And same thing here. They just give us the music, and they're having a great time. These actors can do so much without saying anything. That's the other magic of the show. Because they didn't say anything when they were doing that, when they realized that they were the other's date. When the thing comes through, when the chime mm-hmm. comes through,
and they realize, and the wait, message. That was your phone.
Yeah.
No.
I'm at the bar in the blue suit.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how are we feeling about this relationship as written? I think it's too early to just sort of say where is this going, because it could go it really could go anywhere at this point. We haven't been given a lot of signposts to this plot just started. But how are you feeling about it? Are you feeling comfortable with it?
Is going to be furious. Rebecca's goddaughter is going to be furious.
I think that I was dreading that moment in some ways as much as dreading finding out what's really the deal with Ted, because I thought this is, can go very badly, or if it goes well, it'll eventually go badly. They did a really nice job of making it not super weird
or cringy.
Not cringy in the least. I was like, he's 21. I definitely went like, okay. I mean, I was 21, age of majority, so at least that. But and interestingly, you know, I have been like trying to figure out how old the actor is, and his birthday seems to be, according to one website, currently unknown to the media. So he may be 21. He's not that old, though. You know, generally, actors like who are, you know, when they're supposed to be young people, we find out if we look up their actual birth dates are way older, or at least, you know, 5 to 7 years older than they're playing. And he could be 21. I don't know that, but it didn't cringe me, if that's a good use of the word cringe, but it did. And even the wrap up of it at the end, I was like, first of all, Sam did amazing, you know, press interview there. His talk about we tried, and, you know, that's the most important thing. You have to try. Otherwise, what's the point? And that hitting home, you know, on a personal level with Rebecca, and I think many people, of like, it's much easier to stay out of the game. Don't go on a thing called banter, for sure. But they did it, and when he showed up and she took him inside her apartment and there was smooching, I was like, okay, I'm good with that.
It may not be a good idea, but it's...
I have known so many people who had that moment where it's like, you know, we're both lost. We need this now, and it may not be a great idea, but you do it.
But it's a good, it's a great idea now.
Yeah. And I think we're gonna see a return of the one sponsor who wanted her to get
right
with Sam in the first place.
Yes,
because he's friends with Rupert, and Rupert's not gonna be happy.
Yeah,
no.
I think this is going to go pear-shaped, and I think the two of them will be okay. It's the appearances. They've done a really good job setting it up so it's not cringy, right? You know, again, that was the whole thing with banter, is that you don't know anything about one another. We try to make it as anonymous as possible. And so, you know, it can play innocently that way. And it's and again,
to
it's
us
fine for a rom-com,
but to the public,
but to the public, it just looks weird.
Also,
the paparazzi,
that's their
moment.
Sponsor.
That's right.
Banter's their sponsor. So like, oh well, it's fine because we met on Banter. It doesn't hold the same weight.
So it's not the fairy
fraud
tale that Roy and Keeley are, but
no.
it is a
different fairy tale.
It's a standard rom-com setup, and considering how they screw out with tropes, I can't wait to see what they do to upend it.
Yeah, I feel like it's not going to end well for them collectively, but I think individually they could be better for it. I mean,
yes,
part of what draws Rebecca in terms of the interview is the maturity that he shows in the interview. It is a mature answer for a sports person. Like, for an athlete, that's a really good answer. And it's thoughtful, and it's mature, and it's not pablum. And she just got done saying that he's a child. And he's not a child.
No.
Yep.
And you know, he says specifically, you know, we had to try. We feel bad that we let the fans down, but we tried. And that's what you have to do. And I just thought, you know, flashback to Lyle Levitt. And, you know, you have to try. What would you be if you didn't even try? So please, if it's not too late, make it a cheeseburger.
Yes.
Which is one of my favorite Lyle Lovett songs. But I always think of that. You know, it's, you have to try.
I thought you were making a comment on Lyle and Julia.
Yeah.
But he had to try that too, and you know.
Yeah, and you know, more power to him.
All right, so any final thoughts about Man City before we go to what is apparently going to be a Coach Beard Odyssey next week?
Yeah.
And you might be the title. Literal. If I know anything about this show, it's going to map to something. And if it maps to Homer, like, I'll allow it.
It's going to be a Cyclops.
But final thoughts on Man City.
I love the title because it's not just Manchester City. This is a story filled with men, filled with fathers and sons and towering oppositions and... You know, it is literally Man City all over the place. And even starting off with Beard and Kent, you know, just sort of standing there and facing off. And Keeley just finally being like, yeah, no, I'm not even going to bother. You know, that, again, that's just like this dumb little throwaway moment that is so thematic that sets up everything else.
But, I think that one thing that Ted Lasso... You know, that was a revelation for me when I finally started watching it, is that it is not a bro show. There's bros, and there's a lot of bromance and all of the, you know, the father-son things, but it does not short you on, you know, just human experience in all of its different forms. And even though it's called Man City, it is not just about men.
Yeah.
This is a sort of a broader, silly thought, but I don't know if you guys have talked about the sort of nominative determinism of Will's last name being Kitman.
No.
Yeah, apparently the character's name is Will Kitman.
But I don't think it's been discussed on the show.
It's Will Kitman. It's in the credits. It's Will Kitman, and it's Dr.
It's literally only in the credits.
Oh, is it only in the credits?
Yeah.
Oh, well, but also Dr. Sharon. Like, your therapist's name is Dr. Sharon. Mm-hmm. And they're not above those sorts of clues. So I think it's really... I hadn't thought about it being a City of Men sort of analog until you brought it up. So they did it again. They're sneaky again.
They're here, they're there, they're every... Well, anyway.
Yeah.
All right, David, you know, Phoebe may be listening. Man City, personal pinnacle of the season, as far as I'm concerned, and we've got four more episodes to go. Next time, it's... Beard After Hours, and then just three more after that, and I'll be very depressed because we're going to have to wait for another season after that. Good long discussion of a meaty episode of Ted Lasso. David, thanks for being here.
I love you guys. I'm going to go walk off myself. I got to walk this off. It was a long episode. It was a long thinky episode.
Jean McDonald, thanks for being here.
It was thinky and feely, but at least the ship was well steered by host and coach Chip Sutterth, because I don't know that I wouldn't have otherwise spent like an hour just sniffling and crying. So thank you, Chip.
Thank you, Jean. And Tom McGrath, welcome to Football is Life.
Thanks so much. I'm happy to have left without a subdural hematoma.
All righty then.
And the one thing we've forgotten, pretty good Kermit the Frog impression.
Yeah, it was awesome.
That's not the one thing we've forgotten. We left a lot of meat on this bone.
Well, I guess we're just going to have to watch the damn thing again, shall we?
Oh, please don't make
me. I'll take more notes.
Don't try to have a good time.
Everybody, thank you all so much for listening to this week's episode of Football is Life. We will see you next time.